broadcasting from the University City.
We are Cambridge 105.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon. Thanks to Ian Daborn for the last 2 hours. Welcome to Flavour, the food and drink programme for Cambridge with me, Matt Benman.
Me, Ruth Reyes.
And me, Alan Alder. On Flavour today, we've a couple of new features. We're very pleased to welcome Teen Roche, director of the Cambridge Cookery School. And Teen will be giving the first of her reviews of kitchen equipment. We've also got the first of an occasional series called In the Library, in which we visit one of Cambridge's many libraries in search of books about food and drink from earlier times.
We're also looking ahead to this year's Eat Cambridge Food and Drink Festival. Ben Aveling will be talking about what Radmore Farm Shop of Chesterton Street will be doing. Rich Holmes from the Pint Shop in Peas Hill will be telling us about the three events they are involved with as well.
Do almonds and meat go together? You'll find the answer in a little report from a wine and tapas evening at Cambridge Wine Merchants in Cherry Hinton Road. We'll also be reporting on the steep increases in food proposed for hot food vendors at the Cambridge Market. And to round off, we'll have a pick of the food and drink news from both the university and the city.
The Pint Shop is one of the great things about Cambridge's food and drink scene, and they're involved in three events at the Eat Cambridge Festival, which is in May. Alan went along to speak with Rich Holmes about what they're doing. In the course of the conversation, it emerged that they're about to launch their first beer too.
Rich, is the Pint Shop involved in Eat Cambridge again this year?
Yeah, absolutely. We're doing a number of things with Eat Cambridge. So we're taking part in the main day. We're taking a stall over there and we're going to be taking our Scotch eggs and beer. We're also going to be giving a talk on the day, on the Saturday. Rosie Sykes, our development chef, is coming along with myself and we're going to talk about the menu development process and how we evolve our menu through the seasons and how we work with local suppliers.
I'm quite interested in menus and how they evolve. Do you have data, for example, on which dishes sell well and do you adapt things according to that? Is it a sort of living, breathing, evolving process?
Lots and lots of data. All our tills are hooked up to a back office system and we look at that data. We try to look at it every week, but we definitely look at it when we change the menus. We change our menus 4 times a year. And we definitely get rid of things that haven't moved particularly well and things that are popular. We maybe just play with the garnishes and improve them rather than take them off. But there's no real science to changing the menu, or we haven't found the science to it if it is yet. It's really kind of an evolving thing, a process that we try to improve every time we do it.
As the season progresses, for example, as winter starts changing into spring, are there certain dishes that become perhaps less eaten because perhaps they're heavy and...
Absolutely, yeah, and we see it not only with food but with drink. So to use some kind of cliched ones, I suppose, things like a pie or a stew would definitely slow off as you come out of winter and people start to eat lighter generally. So people tend to eat heavier in the winter and lighter in the summer, and the same applies really in our bar with beers. People really like the dark, heavier beers in the winter months. I guess there's kind of quite a nice comforting thing about that, and then you hit the summer and it's definitely looking for something a bit colder, a bit lighter, something a bit more thirst quenching, maybe not quite as much alcohol because it's hot and don't want to be dehydrated, so they'll go on to lagers and wheat beers.
Oh, that's interesting. Last year you put on a sort of special meal, didn't you, for Eat Cambridge. Will you be doing that again?
Yeah, we're doing another event. So one night during the festival we'll be hosting one of the fringe events. This year it's called East Shop, and we're sourcing all the ingredients for the dinner from within 40 miles of Cambridge, and we're going to attempt to brew a beer to go with one of the courses using local ingredients.
Right, I didn't know you were doing brewing.
Well, we've just started. We're brewing on other people's kit, and we're brewing with people that know much more about brewing than we do. So the idea is that we will team up with a local brewery a couple of times a year, design the beer together, then spend the day at their brewery, brew the beer, and then sell it here.
Is there one on the way?
There is one on the way, yeah. Our first beer should be on the bar in about 2 weeks' time, on the 17th of March. It's called Supersonic, and it's a gin and tonic-inspired wheat beer brewed with our friends at Nene Valley Brewery.
Right, so juniper berries?
Yeah, absolutely. So we used lager malts and pale ale malts to make the liquor, and then we added fresh juniper berries, fresh lemons, orange rind, cinchona bark, and cardamom pods.
Well, that sounds like an interesting beer. Right, I shall be along to try it. Okay, on the Fringe event, when you're doing the East Shop. Is that being cooked in-house, or are you getting people in?
Yeah, so Rosie Sykes, our development chef, will be on the staves that night. And then Andrew Webb, a local food writer, is coming along to host it. So the three of us, Pint Shop, Andrew and Rosie, will be hosting the event. Rosie will be cooking. And it is four courses with matched drinks for £50. And Andrew and Rosie will be entertaining the crowds that night as well. So there'll be some chats in between food, and it should be really good fun. We've done a couple of these style of events, and they're always really good.
Because Andrew did one on pork, didn't he? I think butchering a pig and...
Yeah, so we did Pig Shop last year, which was got our butchers along and Andrew along, and we broke people into teams. And we butchered a pig's head, and then we made some sausages, and we looked at where all the various cuts from pork came from, and then we sat down for dinner and ate, I think it was about five courses of pork inspired food, which is really good actually.
Right, so these things sound pretty interesting.
Yeah, okay. They're great fun. Yeah.
Okay, thanks very much, Rich.
Thank you. Well.
And that was Rich Holmes from the Pint Shop. And we'll have another look forward to Eat Cambridge a little later in the programme, and I can't wait to sample that beer.
That sounds good. The Cambridge Cookery School began several years ago, and its founder, Tine Roche, has featured on Flavour as many times. The school won Best Cookery School in 2013, a Certificate of Excellence from TripAdvisor in 2015, and it also runs Duke of Edinburgh Gold Award residential courses. With a host of cooking classes always on offer, who better than Tine to give her opinion on kitchen gadgets and wares? Here she is now with the first of today's suggestions.
Well, the reason that I would always pick a balloon whisk as my favourite tool is that it's a humble tool, but it can actually do so many amazing things if you know how to use it. And I don't mean any balloon whisk, so mustn't be plastic, mustn't, as they often are, be sort of set on the handle so they're slightly springy, because what happens when you start to use it is that it just splashes whatever it is you're whisking that you see in the wrong direction. So a good balloon whisk, large size, all stainless steel, all sort of sturdy, so no sort of wobbling about, if you like. What it does really is the same thing as electric beaters, and virtually as fast in the right hands and being moved in the right way. So I find this fascinating because it just is such an ancient tool, isn't it, in many ways, and probably hasn't changed that much from the more very basic wired whisks. But if you're making mayonnaise or if you're whipping cream, anything where you're looking for an emulsion, so a thickening of ingredients, and where you have to work really hard, actually, you will see an amazingly quick result from a balloon whisk.
Steady.
No
pressure.
Go. And I think for things like, say, egg white, we all know, you know, the importance of whisking egg whites properly, and you want from soft peak to medium peak to firm peak. You'll often see that in your recipes. If you do that with electric beaters, you probably won't realise that you've gone from soft to medium and from medium to firm. So to have that control, I think that's what I like, that you can constantly look. But most of all, it takes seconds. It's like magic. It's an ingenious tool.
Now whip it!
Yes, so when we run our classes here, we're actually, to some people, maybe disappointingly low-tech. I mean, obviously, as you know, we have fantastic large appliances and small appliances, which we use if we have to. But they're mainly used in-house for us when we're making our sourdough bread and, you know, things like that. But for the classes, I think there's very few things in the kitchen that you cannot do just with your own two hands, almost. Yeah. And, of course, you need a good knife, you need a good whisk and so on, but we prefer not to put electric tools in front of our students or our guests.
Don't over-whip it.
Because if you're going to learn what it is you're actually doing, what the point is of what you're about to do, whether you're beating air into something or emulsifying something, why you're doing it, what's happening, and the fact that you can stop and control it all the time. And it's almost a bit of magic, I think, when you start using a balloon whisker, that people are saying, oh my goodness, I can't believe, you know, how this is happening really quickly. It's fantastic. But it's also, the balloon whisker is interesting because you could use it almost like a spoon and stir very vigorously, and it really won't do a thing. It will be as slow as a wooden spoon would have been. But whisk the way you're meant to whisk, which is sort of more of a swooping movement where you go right down to the bottom of your bowl and lift it out, and you're using your whole shoulder to move your arms, you're beating in lots of air. It's just super efficient. Faster than those electrical appliances.
And that was Teen Roche from Cambridge Cookery School on Hills Road. She'll be back later on in the programme for another kitchen must-have.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Coming up, news from the Cambridge market, Redmore's Farm Shop's Eat Cambridge appearance, and a wine and tapas evening. But first, though, a trip to a Cambridge library.
I wonder how many libraries there are in Cambridge. There's the University Library, and one for each of the colleges, and then there's the main one at Anglia Ruskin, and that totals 33 immediately. Then there's the City Library and the branch libraries. Add that to the university's subject libraries and those in schools and sixth form colleges, and you quickly realise that the answer is a lot. There are some which are rather hidden away too. For example, did you know there's a library in the middle of the Botanic Garden? It's called the Corey Library. And it's very interesting. In my epic search for more books about food in this week of World Book Day, I went along on a wet Tuesday morning to see what they had, and I met librarian Jenny Sargent. I started by asking her how long the library had been there.
There's actually been a library associated with the Botanic Garden for as long as the garden's been in existence, even when it was on its former site in the centre of town. So that's rather exciting.
The former site being the new museum site.
Yes, there's nothing left of it at all now, but the garden was refounded here in the mid-19th century, and some books came with that. And the library's grown since then and finally moved here when they altered the building slightly to accommodate all these books.
And what was the building before then?
So before then, it was actually the director's house, which is rather wonderful. And I've spoken to some of his children who remember growing up here. I think this room was their living room. And they've shown me various other parts of the building that they use. So, yeah, it's wonderful.
What a absolutely magnificent place to live. What sort of books are there here?
Well, it's mainly, as you'd expect, sort of botany, horticulture. It serves the current gardeners. So if they want to look up things, how do I grow this? Or what pest is that? How can, you know, that kind of thing. But also during the 1940s and 50s, when the garden had a great bequest from a chap called Reginald Corey, the directors saw fit to try and develop the library as a real specialist library for history of British horticulture. So at that point, they started buying quite a lot of early books. So we're talking books from the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries on those subjects to really try and make it something that was a real authority in those subject areas.
So you get academics in here.
Yes,
doing their research.
And not only people interested in the history of horticulture and botany, but people who are interested in the history of books, because of course we've got examples of old bindings, you know, the ways that books were produced back in before the sort of mid-19th century was completely different from how it's done now.
And have you got many books on growing things you can eat, fruits, vegetables?
It's not a sort of specialist area of the library, and of course in terms of the modern works here, the garden staff aren't really growing any of that kind of thing. But in terms of the earlier books, it comes into the subject matter of a lot of those, because they were providing really manuals for the gardener or the lord of the manor to consult. So alongside telling you when you might need to plant your roses or prune whatever, they're also telling you about the kitchen garden, which of course is so important when you need to do things to grow your herbs and your orchards, that kind of thing.
Are these some of them, these books that are laid out on the table? They look pretty old.
Yes, some of them are. So I've put a little selection out here, and we're going right through from this lovely old speckled leather volume, which was published in 1594, through the various centuries, right up to Mr. Loudon, who some of your listeners might recognise that name. He was a prolific writer, and he published that in 1842, Loud and Suburban Horticulturist. He wrote reams and reams trying to educate his reader on how to have the ideal garden and what to do with it and when.
And what about the contents? Anything that we might find of interest?
Certainly, I'm sure. So let's have a look. Mr. Switzer, Stephen Switzer, he wrote an awful lot of useful books. So Switzer's Fruit Garden is
that's
one.
That's rather a nice binding as well.
It's a lovely old leather binding. You see various bits of decoration there. And then inside, as we open it up, we come across not only a lot of text, but these wonderful fold-out little diagrams and plans. So here we've got the plan of a fruit or kitchen garden on two different levels for early and late productions.
Gosh.
So it's really going into all the detail of what you might need to put where. So they're really trying to help the reader to plan the formal areas of their gardens.
And a very nice sort of geometric plan as well.
Yes,
physically beautiful.
Yes, and in fact, things like this would obviously increase the production costs for a book. So to have an engraving like this is something, that's more than just printing text. So, lovely contents.
And heavily annotated by somebody.
Yes, that's one of the wonderful things about lots of the books in here. Because they're such practical books, manuals on how to do things in your garden, they've been used by people. So they've been annotated. And you can learn all sorts of things about what the people who are reading them thought was important. So these books aren't just interesting for their textual content. They're interesting because they can tell us so much about the history and the people that were associated with them, which is wonderful. There's a particularly nice example of annotation in this book from 1715. So just opening up that front cover, and you can see on the inside of the cover, somebody has written down all sorts of measurements, obviously relating to their estate, I think. So from the door to the kitchen garden gate, 9 rods. So I'm not very good hot on this, but I gather a rod was a previous method of measuring.
It's still used in the world of allotments.
So, just inside this book, we haven't even got to the printed contents, but we found out something about somebody, a former owner, which is wonderful. And then as you turn through it, you can see that he's even inserted some blank pages so he can make his own notes about various things. So there's a lot more to these books than you might expect.
Yes. And I guess by looking through these books, you can see what people must have liked to grow. I mean, is there anything...
Exactly.
Anything take you by surprise?
Yeah, but you'll find things like plans for example, a melonry. So, it's interesting to think about when certain fruit and vegetables became important for being produced.
But a melonry implies some really quite nice hot weather, doesn't it?
It would do if it was being grown in its natural way, but these melonries would have these hot beds in them. I gather there would be a way of actually heating the area in which they were grown. So all sorts of techniques developed for enabling us in this country that doesn't enjoy that weather to be able to grow these things.
Right, so they put a lot of work, expense...
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, and it's interesting because some of these books were obviously aimed at the person who has a large estate, and some of them, often the smaller volumes, the much less illustrated, because of course the illustrations were expensive, were clearly aimed at the person who was actually doing the growing. So you've got books being written to appeal to not just the gardener, the man getting his hands dirty, but the lord of the manor as well. So this is Calendarium Hortense, the Gardener's Almanac by John Evelyn. And this is typical of the kind of book that broke the year into its months and gave you strict instructions as to what to do in each month. So we can look here at March, as it's March now. So it's got some information about March, has 31 days. And then it tells you what to do in each area of the garden during that period. So
the orchard, the olitory garden.
The olitory garden. So here we go. Now is your chiefest and best time for raising on the hotbed melons, cucumbers, gourds, etc., which about the 6th, 8th or 10th day will be ready for the seed. So it's very specific. If you don't know what it is you're supposed to be doing in your garden, you can turn to your little pocket-sized book here and find out. So this is quite typical of the kind of thing that was being produced to help that squire with his gardening. And also, some of them often say in their introductions that they're to help the lord of the manor make sure his gardeners are doing what they should be. because I think there was a feeling that the gardeners had all this knowledge in an area the squire knew nothing about. And so he, you know, he needs to get educated so he knows that they're working as hard as they should be.
So they're suspicious of the working classes.
Just a bit.
Yeah. Look at this. Now also plant peaches and nectarines.
Mm.
And this is, what year is this
so
book again?
So when is this one published? So we just turn back to the title page and we see London 1706.
So people were growing peaches and nectarines in this country in 1706.
It seems that things were quite sophisticated. And when you look at those plans for creating the areas where you'll grow those things, that they really knew what they were doing in terms of creating the right conditions for growing such things.
Yeah. Gosh, I'm amazed.
Mm.
Where did these books come from, by the way? Have they been handed down and eventually donated to the library?
Some of them have. A lot of them were bought in that period that I mentioned when our directors in the 1940s and 50s were actually putting quite a bit of money into developing this collection. And that's what makes them so interesting, because they haven't just sat here on the shelves since the day they were published. They've actually had lives with people and been used by people, and only then when they've, you know, come up at auction or whatever in the 1950s have they ended up being here. So that's why they're so interesting, because they've got all that evidence in them of the people that used them. We're not collecting early material like this anymore. What we're mainly buying at the moment is things to support our gardeners. So if the gardeners want to develop something new and we don't have any books on that, then we'll ask them for recommendations.
Right. So in fact, what you're doing is creating your own history for the future.
Well, exactly, yes. Yeah, that's it, yeah. Mm.
Right, well, thanks very much, Jenny. I could spend hours here.
Yes.
on a wet day like today. It's quite an attractive
proposition.
Thanks very much.
You're
That's
welcome.
Great. Thanks.
And that was Jenny Sargent at the Quarry Library in the Botanic Garden, which you can visit by appointment.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting library. It's got a fantastic smell, you know, the way old books smell, and it's got this heavy silence as well. It's good.
Every fortnight, Bums on Seats brings debate and discussion on the latest movie releases. From blockbusters to art house, our panel of reviewers are passionate about film.
There's one thing in common, and that's that I think they're all absolutely brilliant.
Well, you can see the ending by watching the trailer, because I was surprised they show it in the trailer.
You wouldn't know it was the ending if you hadn't just said it.
And we'll agree to disagree.
No, I don't agree.
Hosted by Toby Miller.
We take the latest cinema releases for a dance and a drink and report back on which ones have turned our eye and captured our heart, and which ones will be blanking in the street if we happen to pass them.
Join the team. Alternate Saturdays at 12 noon on Community Radio in your city. Cambridge 105.
Well, back to the kitchen now, as Teen Roche from the Cambridge Cookery School offers her next suggestion on the road to culinary perfection.
One of my absolute favourite tools, if you can call it a tool in the kitchen, is a really, really good roasting tray. And this may sound surprising, but a good roasting tray makes such a huge difference to the end result of anything that you roast, obviously. And it's the make or break of so many things. So you could be preparing perfectly a leg of lamb or any other roasted vegetables, and put them in a roasting tin that isn't quite non-stick, or it came as non-stick, but after a few months or years of wear and tear, it's no longer non-stick. We all know what they look like. And your carefully prepared dishes, say roast potatoes, it's very annoying, isn't it, when they stick to the roasting tin, and that lovely crunchy exterior of your fluffy roast potato actually gets left behind, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yeah.
And it's the best bit. So that's all the difference between a really good roasting tin and a not so good one. So I remember that one of the first, I thought, serious purchases I made, this was for home use before I ran the cookery school, about 20 years ago, I bought a roasting tin, and it cost £80 then, which I thought was astronomical. But I had heard that it was amazing, so I thought, well, I'm going to buy this roasting tin, and I still have it. And in fact, once I realized how very, very good it was, I bought another one. So I have two that have both been with me then for about 20 years. I don't know, but I assume £80 20 years ago probably be 250-300 now. And you think twice before buying a roasting tin that costs that. But I've chucked all the others, there's no point using them. I can only fit in two big roasting tins in my oven, so 2 years enough, and they are fantastic. And not only are they cooking everything brilliantly, but they're easy to wash up as well. So you're not standing there, you know, at 11 o'clock at night, cursing it because there's bits stuck to it. Because they're not stuck to it, they're still on the food, or they were still on the food. So really, really thick. I don't know how many layers, I don't know the ins and outs of these roasting tins, but they are simply amazing.
with performance as good today as they were 20 years ago.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. Almost better, I suppose, because, you know, some things get a bit of a patina, don't they? But
yes,
certainly as good as, if not slightly better. And I think after 20 years of constant wear and tear, and I actually roast quite a lot, you know, as a cook, I don't particularly want to stand by the stove, certainly not if I have guests there. Mm. I often think about whether I can be bothered to let my house smell of fish or whatever, or a chicken roast, and I'll put it in the oven instead. So they have worked very, very hard. They're in use, constant use, probably 3 or 4 times a week, and they're still brilliant after 20 years.
Do a lot of your students come along asking for advice as well after their classes?
Yes, a lot of students and our corporate visitors as well ask us what it is they've just used. And I know the look on their faces when I tell them the price, but I am then saying, but it is the only roasting tin you need to ever buy. You know, I'm not just saying that. I know it because I'm still cooking with some of them 20 years later that you get, yeah, you just get a thing for life. It's wonderful. Particularly now, I think, when we are so into kind of wear and tear, aren't we? We just chuck things. We don't expect much to last very long. You know, even our expensive electronic gadgets, we expect them to last a finite number of years. So for something like this, a daily tool that makes my life easier and makes me feel happy because my cooking works out, to function for 20 years, and to be honest, I don't expect it to change. I think I will have this with me till my dying days. I will be buried with it. It'd be like the Viking graves. She's going to the other side and still cook, obviously.
Many thanks to Tina Roche of the Cambridge Cookery School, which is just off Hills Road behind Homerton College. Their website is cambridgecookeryschool.com. Some of their classes available next week, they include knife skills, Italian Inverno, which is making fresh focaccia, tagliatelle, lemon, pear and almond torta, and lots more, all from seasonal British produce, and curries of the world. This is where you'll get to make authentic curries, produce perfect rice and hob-baked flatbreads. If you'd like to find out more, it's all on their website, where you can also book.
Later this month, Cambridge City Councillors will be deciding whether to increase charges for the stallholders at the market. Stallholders pay a pitch fee for each day they are there, and Jamie Rice from the Cambridge Paella Company talked with Alan about the increase.
Well, I think for small independent businesses like us, you know, local businesses, it will have quite an impact. In real terms, it's, I think, just over 50% increase on a daily basis, and that's per stall. Now, we're fortunate enough that we just inhabit one stall, but if we had two, obviously, you know, it'd be an extra £14 per day. And if we were placed on the outside, there's also going to be a proposed increase on premium pitches as well. So some food traders are looking at, you know, a significant increase in their daily pitch fees. Yeah, I mean, at the moment it's just a proposal and a consultation, I think. But I suppose in my experience, you know, a consultation is often just a period of time. We live in the real world. We know that, you know, charges inevitably go up in all walks of life, and we've questioned the rationale as to what's behind this. And the answers we get are that it's to do with our, I suppose, water and electrical charges, and also some cleaning, I think, issues on the market square. So, but it does seem very steep, really.
So what are people going to do? What are you going to do?
Well, we've been invited to submit our views to the council, which we've done. You know, they gave us a deadline to do that, and I know myself and other traders have done that. We've asked for the rationale. I mean, for example, I can't speak for other traders, but we use gas to cook our actual products, so we're fairly self-sufficient. So, I mean, their argument that, you know, it's the amount of electricity we use, really, you know, it doesn't ring true, certainly not for us. Also, you know, in terms of cleaning services for the market square, it's, again, a bit harsh to say that hot food traders, you know, make a mess. I mean, we don't. We often come to a stall, depending on who's been on it before you, and find that we have to do a little bit of tidying up and cleaning up, but we always leave it clean and tidy. Likewise, the water that we use, there are non-food stalls that use considerably more water than we do. For instance, the flour stalls, you know, gallons and gallons every day. So all we're asking for is fairness, really. And if things have to go up, that ideally it's done gradually, it's done, you know, realistically, and that increases are based on actual real usage of utilities rather than perceived.
Will you have to put prices up?
We're really loath to pass any kind of knock-on effects on to our customers. I mean, we've only been on the market since April 2015, so we're approaching our first year. And in that year, we've built a really, you know, good, solid, regular customer base. But it's taken time. We do have it now. We see familiar faces and people come back. So it would be really disappointing to actually say, well, thanks for, you know, coming and buying our food. Thanks for supporting us. You know, you've been doing it for 9 months and now we're going to increase the price of your lunch. We'd rather not do that. So I think probably realistically we would, you know, we would foot the bill and take the hit with a view to not passing it on to the consumers. But obviously we just have to see how things pan out in the future.
Well, whatever happens, I hope it goes well for you.
Thank you very much.
And that was Jamie from the Cambridge Paella Company. And after speaking with him, I went to see Dan Ritchie from the City Council. He's the Market and Trading Development Manager.
We've conducted a benchmarking review of other regional and national market operators about the charges that they levy on their traders compared with the fees that we charge our traders. And what has been identified is that most market operators that permit casual trading, ad hoc, daily trading, charge at a higher rate, and we currently don't. Most market operators charge additionally for services like electricity. We currently don't. And most market operators charge administration fees, which we currently don't. So essentially, the proposals are to bring our market offer into line with what other market operators do.
Are the hot food vendors having a bigger increase than others then?
Well, clearly, what's important to reiterate is other market operators already impose these charges on their traders. And we currently don't impose any charges for electricity use, as an example. If you make a distinction that hot food traders generally have a greater impact on utilities and cleansing and refuse costs, then the impact, you don't have to pass on the costs across the board.
Things are never as simple as they seem, are they? Uh-huh. But, I mean, a florist would use a lot of water, wouldn't they?
I would take the point that there are some non-hot food traders that use an amount of electricity and an amount of the utilities and the things that you've just referred to that they would use more than perhaps a haberdashery store. But I would contend that most of the examples that you've just put forward would use less than the average hot food seller.
Right, OK. And as you said, it's proposals anyway, and there's been consultation, so we don't know what the final decision is.
Absolutely, that they are proposals. The traders were consulted on. 27 of the 195 traders have written feedback, and their comments and observations will be taken into account at the scrutiny committee on the 17th of March.
Yeah, right. Well, thanks very much, Dan. Thank you.
Right, so if people at the market do put up their prices, you'll know why. But I think you have to see it against the backdrop of the fact that the City Council does now receive 53% less core funding from the government than it did in 2010. And in fact, the drop in the last year alone has been 15%, and with more cuts to come.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Right, we've been following tweets. There's been a rather urgent tweet from Burwash Manor, which we need to bring to your attention. They need a food van tomorrow. So if you operate a food van or fancy it, Matt Roof, let Burwash Manor know. And also Inda's Kitchen. You can order before midnight for delivery on Mother's Day for their frozen curries, which I've said before, I'll say it again, are fantastic.
I've discovered a really interesting cake stall on the market run by Victoria Gold Freeman. It's called Victoria's Slice. Obviously, the cakes look great, so I just had to find out more. You've just started in the market and you do these amazing cakes. Tell us a bit more about them.
I'm just trying to go for more unique flavours, to be honest, and try and do things that are vegan, gluten-free, everything, so that everyone can have them.
Tell us one of the different flavours. I think I read it was parsnip and
I have vegan parsnip and pineapple ones.
That's amazing.
Which are proving very popular today. We've almost sold out of them.
So how do you come up with these flavours?
It's really just experimentation. Like, I get inspiration from different things. One night I was having stir fry for dinner and I was like, well, if you can have coconut, chili and ginger in a stir fry, why can't you have it in a cake? So then I created a coconut, chili and ginger cake. So do you just sell on the market? No, I do cakes to order as well. So if you email me, then I can send order forms and I do boutique cakes, layer cakes, basically anything.
The gluten-free and all that, just because you want everyone to enjoy a good cake?
Partly, but one of my best friends is also gluten-free, and I've got a couple friends who are celiac, and they always struggle trying to be able to find things that they're able to have. So I thought it would be nice if it was successful for everyone.
What makes the vegan and gluten-free cupcakes? How do you make that happen?
So the vegan ones, obviously, they have no eggs, they have no butter. So instead I use things like almond yogurt and almond milk. And then with the gluten-free ones, it has ground almonds as the base rather than flour, so I don't have to use any gluten in them.
How long have you been baking?
Probably since I was about 6. I've been baking forever. Always baking. No, yeah, that's pretty much everything. Cool. Come and see us.
Brilliant. Cool, thank you. And that was Victoria Gold Freeman from Victoria's Slice. She's got some really interesting flavours, like an Earl Grey and lavender cake. So definitely look out for her.
I'm going to. Right, it's just a couple of months now until our big food festival. And we caught up with another name involved in it. This is Ben Aveling from the Radmore Farm Shop on Chesterton Road.
Ben, you're going to have a stall at the Eat Cabbage event this year.
I certainly am, and I'm looking forward to it. Last year I attended the event. I only recently heard about it at the time, sort of not new on the food scene, but new on maybe the social media and the Twitter scene. I hadn't seen it as much as I'd hoped, so I stumbled across it and visited it, and I thought, I've got to be here next year. Probably sure I was one of the first people to sign up, because I got the email this year, and I responded that night with all the criteria, and I thought, right, we really need to be part of it, because our shop is massively on the up. Our customers are on the up. We've got probably three times as many products than we've ever had before, even more made by ourselves. And we thought, who better to be at Eat Cambridge than us, really? We really wanted to push that and be there for our customers too. And showing your face is very important, and to build relationships with customers, I think.
So what can we expect to see there on the Radmore Farm stall?
Well, basically, I think that I'll be bringing a focused amount of my products, maybe some of my wife's cakes, our handmade pies, some of our meats, and maybe a small selection of some of the other of my best-selling products. But I also want to promote the fact that we do local deliveries and have an online store, make us much more approachable to the whole of Cambridge, because I think people think because you're a small shop that they deal with you like you're a small business, but we have so much going on. We can supply people with produce that they wouldn't even believe at great prices. And I think people would really be intrigued to know actually how much they could get from us, how much they'd probably save from other places, and the quality as well. Sort of just give them an idea of the whole package, really, and really give us a chance to put ourselves at the front and show everybody what we're about.
Can we mention in a little bit more detail some of your wife's cakes, some of your handmade pies?
Yes, well, this week we've just made the ultimate minced beef and onion pie. And we wanted to make our own version of the basic classic minced beef and onion pie. We were a bit apprehensive about the idea. I made it like my steak and ale kind of way with lots and lots of beer. Yeah. And it's just absolutely packed through. And that's nearly sold out already this week. And we called it the ultimate minced beef and onion pie. So that's the sort of thing you'll be seeing. My wife's cakes, they are coming in and selling out hot cakes. Brilliant, thank you. And it's a joke. It's almost a joke. We cannot keep up. The cakes, they're made all wooden spoon mix, best wholesome ingredients, no rubbish. They've got a good shelf life, so you can buy one. You don't have to eat it straight away. You don't have to go in the fridge. They are just perfect. A real traditional cake. That's the thing, and that's why they sell so well. They're not overly dressed. A lot of people buy them thinking I should make a cake. It's like a cake I would make. Yeah. So it makes it more approachable to buy. They sort of think, well, this is the next best thing to me making one. And that's how the whole cake trade started. And then since then, it's just grown and grown and grown. Lemon Drizzle sells 4-1 to every other cake because we just use proper ingredients. We use all our own lemon juice that we from the lemons in the shop. It's just simple, really. Yeah.
So you're very out there, you know, you're engaged in the community, you're very media savvy, and you have your own column?
Yes, the Cambridge News. My monthly column is the first weekend of every month. When we were in the Food and Drink Awards, we were one of the runners-up. Because the fact we have our own farm, there's loads of farm shops on farms, tied to farms, but very, very, very rarely are they their own farm like us. So I said something like that might be of real interest to customers, people in Cambridge. I have regular talks with my customers daily. The general public are quite interested in farming, and it's not on the forefront of people's day-to-day lives anymore. Mm. So they're really intrigued. And they're also interested in all the cuts of meat that you have and the fact that you're hands-on with not only the animals, but with the butchery and the production of all the food. And yeah, so now we've got this called A Farmer's Life in the Cambridge News, and we write that. And it's all to do with the farm, what we produce, very small hints to recipes. It's not a recipe column, but I will suggest something that I think is a really good way to cheat family dinners, really quality food, but really cheap, really easy, and give it an approachable sort of way of cooking to people who might just need something in a hurry. And our interpretation of day-to-day life on the farm, for example, this month's column will be, I've touched on the whole pig farming story, which everyone is listening to in the news at the moment, and how pigs are, you know, it's quite a tough time at the moment. So, you know, we're touching on serious issues, but it's not a serious column.
Great. Well, thanks very much, Ben. Right, we will see you there in May.
Certainly will. I'll look forward to it.
Well, thanks to Ben Aveling from the Radmore Farm Shop, who's going great guns with his farm and butchery business. Ben has featured in previous episodes of Flavour. Most recently, he popped up in our Mitcham's Christmas Fair feature from our December programme, and you can hear that and plenty of other features from a host of the city's independent food and drink producers via the Cambridge 105 podcast page. Or you can subscribe to Flavour in iTunes, the Radio Player app, and failing that, you can listen to us on DAB or even good old FM.
Yeah. There's a new collaboration going on over at the Cherry Hinton Road branch of the Cambridge Wine Merchants. It's Wine and Tapas. Alice Archer, a wine specialist who regularly contributes to Flavour, has teamed up with another Flavour familiar, Estefania Led Ramos of Carrico Tapas. I popped in on one of their Friday night sessions to capture a little bit of the spirit. Oh, that's a wine gag, by the way. My only wine gag.
So for a year and a half now, we've had the steak and olive van outside on a Thursday night. So we're trying to run it in a similar way, where people order food from Carrico Tapas and they order wine from us. Mm. I put a couple of special Spanish wines on by the glass. So, for example, Estefania's currently drinking a 2009 Garnacha. Garnacha. That's quite a bold wine.
Quite full body.
It's a really nice space and it's really relaxed. Think of it like as a pub for wine, you know.
People order food as they go, they order wine as they go. It's not this formal, stick to this menu,
you've
got to have these
wines.
We
wanted to replicate a tapas night in Spain. That's you pop in different bars and have different tapas with different wines. Mm. As we can do it in different places here, we decided to join Cambridge Wine Merchants in Cherry Hinton and then offer different tapas and different wines every night so people can choose different flavours every Friday.
Mm. To my mind, the food is an excuse to come here and drink the wine.
Sounds like a bit like an alcoholic.
Well, no, if I were an alcoholic, I wouldn't need an excuse to come here and drink the wine, right?
How you came to meet up with Alice to create an evening like this.
We chatted maybe about 2 years ago.
2 years ago, probably.
And we came up with a few ideas for more structured events. Like, you get, these are your tapas, these are your wines, it's a tapas and wine matching evening, you've got to pay your ticket price in advance, you've got to turn up, you've got to do this. People didn't quite catch on to it, I think. But then we did an event with some sherries recently that worked really well, and we thought, well, why not just give it a go as a more of a free-for-all, more of a casual Friday night
casual.
Turn up. Yeah. You buy your food, you buy your wine. I think Cambridge is reacting better to the more casual kind of event as opposed to this, pay your price now, this is exactly the food you're getting.
Yeah, so I think I found out about it on Twitter. I think they advertised all the Cambridge Wine Merchants events, and I saw there was tapas and wine. I thought, yeah, that sounds pretty good. So I invited a few friends along, thought it would be a nice evening.
My aim is that people taste different flavours from Spain. Sometimes we are a bit constricted by topics like paella or ham, and we have much more. So I try to combine these popular dishes with others that maybe people don't have the opportunity to taste in England, because it's more difficult to get ingredients or to get traditional recipes. It's what I'm doing.
Vegetable skewers and anchovies to put on bread.
Anchovies from the north of Spain, the Cantabric Sea. delicious. I mean, it is not salty at all.
Yeah, so they had quite a good vegetarian option as well, like mixing that up with the asparagus is a different.
Yeah, no, yeah. The asparagus was very nice.
I'm not saying that if you go out and you have tapas maybe with more English flavour is bad. I mean, that you are used to these kind of flavours. It's like in Spain, the Chinese restaurants are completely different from England because we are used to different flavours and we have to adapt that. Yeah, real food. And that's it.
I'm trying to compare it perhaps to things like Indian curries. You know, tikka masala was developed for the English palate. Mm-hmm. If all you've had are curries that are developed for the English palate, you've never really tried a true Indian curry yet.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's sort of a similar fashion when it comes to the tapas.
Mm-hmm. Can I try and make an example from tonight? You could say I'm completely wrong, but on the menu we had meatballs served with an almond sauce. Mm. It was absolutely delicious. But I think that's something that you wouldn't really see on an English tapas menu. You'd see meatballs, but perhaps with the sauce that you'd have on top of patatas bravas. Some more kind of tomato-y based sauce.
Yeah.
That's a more comforting thing for the English palate. That's something more familiar. Whereas this almond sauce was traditional and delicious.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's something more different that you don't have the opportunity to taste in other places with almond sauce. That is something that my mom cooked for years, and I love it.
Stunning.
You say, can you mix the almonds with
almonds and meat? Yeah,
you know, these kind of things. I say, yes, of course, and it works, and it's really delicious.
I think the nicest one was they had some meatballs with like an almondy sauce, which is really lovely. The bread was really good.
So we've got tapas nights on Fridays, and then we're going to do a quarterly event. So those will be little wine tours of regions of Spain.
Yes.
So the first one's going to be kind of the north, northwest.
Yes.
It's like Galicia, Toro, Rueda, that kind of area. And then we've also got a special event for St. George's Day, because St. George is also very important in Aragon, in Spain.
My region.
Which is where Estefania's originally from.
And with wines as well from
with wines from Aragon
and Aragon.
And Rioja and Calatayud and places like that.
And next week, I don't know, it's a surprise.
It could be anything.
Lovely. Well, thank you very much, Estefania and Alice.
Not at all.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Come along, it's a really nice way to spend an evening.
Many thanks to Alice Archer and Estefania Le Ramos. The next wine and tapas evening takes place at the Cherry Hinton branch of Cambridge Wine Merchants on Friday the 18th of March. You can just turn up, as they suggested, that is, after all, the tapas way in Spain, and it's what Matt did all the time when he was over there at Christmas. Or you can book a table by calling Cambridge 214 548 or emailing cherry@cambridgewine.com. That's an evening of authentic Spanish tapas by Estefania, following her grandmother's recipes, coupled with Alice's selection of Spanish wines.
On to the food and drink news now. Gigi Perry from Pembroke College has sent us the following university news.
Right, tomorrow, that's Sunday the 6th, the Cambridge University Blind Wine Tasting Society is running a blind tasting where the theme is soil, that is, the soil that the grapevines grow in. This is tied strongly to the French concept of terroir. And if you've ever been to a talk by a winemaker, the soil types employed are usually discussed. It'll take place at 7 p.m. at Queen's College. Tickets cost £14 and can be bought online. And if you listen with envy to what this society gets up to and wish you were a student again, we have some good news coming up shortly in the city news section. But continuing with the university, Cambridge University Wine Society is holding its annual dinner on Thursday the 10th of March. The five-course menu has just been released. It features a goat cheese and beetroot salad to start, followed by poached salmon with fennel and cucumber, and then a champagne sorbet. The main is roast guinea fowl supreme with celeriac dauphinoise, greens and roasted roots, and a lemon meringue tart with tangerine delice for pudding. Wines have been confirmed, all 15 of them. Too many to list here, but needless to say, there will be a lot of wine, and it will be flowing. Tickets can be bought online, and it takes place at 7 p.m. at Darwin College. And Cambridge University Food Bank Society is a newly formed Cambridge University student group whose membership has grown to over 300 since the beginning of the year. The society aims to combat food waste across the university and help tackle food poverty in Cambridge.
It has placed boxes to collect donations of tinned food in 9 colleges and will be putting pressure on colleges to give more of the food left over from formals and May balls to local charity. Daniel Zeichner, MP, said, "Seeing good food go to waste is a scandal."
On to the city news now, starting with news about flavour. Beginning next Saturday, we will have a monthly full-page article in the Cambridge News. In it, we'll be saying something about what's coming up in the next couple of flavour programmes, so do look out for it.
Right now at Burwash Manor is Juicy Swine, and they're serving brunch and lunch.
Also right now, and rather closer to the studio, Steak and Honour are serving at Calverley's Brewery in Hooper Street until 3 p.m. Can we avoid the temptation? Well, we're starving in here.
We are.
They'll also be at Novi from 5:30 to 9 p.m. this evening, and taking over at Calverley's will be Gorilla Kitchen, who will be there from 6 till 9.
The next Mill Road Feast will be tomorrow from 11 till 4 in the Guider Street car park. It will feature an extraordinary number of people. Jack's Gelato, Jalan Jalan, Roasty Strasse, Gorilla Kitchen, Wandering Yak, Bejer's Bebidas, Martha Rosie Bakes, Holy Schnitzels, The Lick, Ali's Baltic Bakes, Go Go Goji Gooey, Cambridge Pie Company, Sweet and Spicy, Cadwyn Curries, Fired Up Pizza, Steak and Honour, Athahar Spanish Tapas, Schmerg Meister Chili Sauces, and that's it, really, so spoilt for choice. That's the Mill Road Feast tomorrow, 11 to 4.
And if you miss Gorilla Kitchen at the feast, you can have several other chances next week because they will be serving up in Cambridge Market on Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday lunchtimes.
I know where I'll be getting my lunch.
Now back to blind wine tasting. Well, there's a former president of the Cambridge University Blind Tasting Society. He has an event coming up in the tasting room at the Cambridge Wine Merchants in Mill Road. It's called Taste and Test. It's a pub quiz-style wine tasting. Now, you can go as a team of, say, 3 or 4, or you can go independently and form a team on the night. He will teach you the basics of blind tasting and pitch you against one another. Prizes for the winning team, great wine, and lots of fun for everyone. It's on the 7th of March. It costs £20 per person. Book at one of the branches or call Cambridge 568 992.
And if you want to know more about jamón, there's a talk and tasting along with a glass of wine at the Spanish Centre in Hills Road on the 11th of March, 6 till 7:30, and that will cost £15.
The Cambridge Science Festival is coming up. There's quite a few food-related events. For example, on the 11th of March, cod liver oil, old habits die hard, which looks at what reasons there might be to use supplementary diets today.
Also on the 11th of March, the genetic and cultural history of our dietary relationships with starch, milk and alcohol.
11th of March is a busy day. There's also another pop-up from the very popular CAM events at Sticky Beaks in Hobson Street. This is a Spanish tapas and wines evening, and Guillermo of Tapa Azaha will be serving 6 courses of tapas and 3 matched wines for £32.50, plus £10 for a welcoming glass of cava or sherry and olives and lemons to go with it. Yesterday, there were still 2 tables available. Go to Eventbrite for details.
Meanwhile, back at the Science Festival, on the 12th of March, there's a drop-in chocolate trial at the Guild Hall. And in the same venue, you can also find out about metabolism, fat and fitness, science and cereal packets, and the science of eating. The festival runs for 2 weeks and there's a lot on, so you can go to the website or look out for the brochure. You'll also need to book in advance for many of the events.
There's a fundraising meal for Food Cycle, 3 courses for a very reasonable £12. It's on the 19th of March. That's at St Paul's Church in Hills Road and it's from 7 p.m. and you book via the Transition Cambridge website.
On Saturday, the 12th of March, at the Cambridge Cookery School, from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m, Spring Fish. This is a class that will introduce you to fantastic fish straight from Billingsgate. You'll learn about sustainability, how to identify fresh fish, how to gut and fillet flat and round fish, as well as which cooking methods suit which types of fish. The spring class includes an aromatic Italian trout wrapped in prosciutto and a Venetian recipe for sweet and sour mackerel, a classic Swedish salmon and dill gratin, Scottish mussels and saffron and white wine, as well as a classic fish sauces, including mayonnaise and remoulade. The Saturday morning starts with coffee, tea and cake and finishes with a magnificent fish lunch and a glass of chilled white wine. Those courses are at the Cambridge Cookery School in Hills Road.
Yeah, they sound good. Right, looking ahead to May, The celebrity chef lineup for 2016's Ely Food and Drink Festival has been announced. Now, this is taking place on the 1st and 2nd of May. It will feature Jean-Christophe Novelli, the award-winning French chef and Michelin star restaurateur. And he simply loved being at the event last year, apparently, and is back by popular demand. Joining him will be Jack Stein, son of Rick, and a executive chef of the Stein restaurants. He'll be relaying stories of restaurant life from Padstow and cooking up a flavoursome fish dish. And the final chef on the books is local talent Ian Cumming, the Cambridge-based photographer and finalist from 2015's The Great British Bake Off. He'll be demonstrating his creative talents as well as giving the lowdown on his new celebrity status. Well, there's lots more events and you can find details at visiteely.org.uk.
And sadly, that's all the time that we have for Flavour today. If you missed some of our programme, you can listen again tomorrow at 7 a.m. on Cambridge 105, and the podcast will be available from early next week. And remember, you can email us, flavour@cambridge105.fm, or you can follow us on Twitter, @Flavour105.
And coming up next is Mandy's Garden Shed, in which Mandy gets a guided tour of a special garden in Grantchester, designed by Chelsea Gold Medal winner Marnie Hall. At 2 p.m, Radio Dante, from 3 till 5, 105 Sport, and at 5 p.m, the first edition of a new weekend magazine centred on Cambridge, in which Tony Barnfield celebrates International Women's Day with special guests, Baroness Julia Neuberger, who reflects on her days at Newnham Common. From 6 till 7, Mike Pryor is here with his soul show, and from 7 till 8, I'll be back with Rocklit, looking at music blogs, and including some very good music, and you really should listen to it. And if you're going out, listen instead tomorrow when it's repeated at 2 o'clock.
But until our next programme on the 19th of March, goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye.